Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Janine Hall Gailey, writer and poet, and we're talking about her new collection of poems, Flare Corona. Janine, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Now, this is your seventh book of poetry?
It is six. I've got another one hopefully on the way.
When do you think that's going to be released?
I think BOA asked for you to wait for a year and a half to submit it, but I'm working on it now.
Because you don't want to put it too close to this one.
Yeah, you don't want to be like, hey, everybody, buy my book, and then 6 months later, buy another book. Yeah, exactly.
And I just keep cranking them out.
Now,
this collection really took me by surprise. I didn't know what to expect, okay? I purposely didn't read any other poetry by you until I opened this book. And would you call the collection is dark?
For me, it's more personal, and I would say all of my books are a little dark. I mean, I've got kind of a dark sense of humor, but the other books have more, you know, comic books or fairy tales or sci-fi, and there's a little bit of that in here, but mostly this is a tale of a journey that's not really fun, which was being diagnosed with terminal cancer and then being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So it wasn't a ton of fun. It was a super fun time, but I tried to put some levity in there, but...
You did.
Yeah.
You did.
I tried.
You tried, and you succeeded. Now,
I hope so.
Going on this journey with you through this poetry, and I just want to mention to the benefit of the audience, this is not didactic. The poems are really interesting. They're powerful, and we'll talk about different themes on them. But I can't believe you sort of went through all of that and then COVID.
Yeah, that was super.
This like the frosting on the cake?
Yeah. I was finally feeling better too. I was like to a good place. I was like, finally things are getting better. And you know, it was so weird because that poem Calamity, which was one of the first poems of the book, I wrote right after reading in the news. I think it was November 2019. I said, oh, a doctor was put in prison for talking about a new virus. And I was like, oh, what? I don't want to curse, but you know, oh something. You know what I mean? I could see it coming. I was like, oh, that's not a good sign. I've seen that movie. I've seen that disaster movie. It's coming, you know?
The thing is, you've earned that epithet. I think you've gone through the...
Don't watch the movie Contagion right before pandemic, because I did that.
Went in for surgery, just to have my gallbladder removed, I actually watched Coma just before I went in. That was dumb.
And don't watch any House episodes or
X-Files. Right, no.
Everybody's always having seizures in the MRI machine.
I want to ask you, before your several serious medical challenges, was your poetry different in tone and concept and subject matter?
I would say I kind of avoided writing too much about my personal life.
This is very personal.
Yeah, and this is, so I kind of avoided autobiography before this. I wrote a lot of persona poems. My most personal book before this was The Robot Scientist's Daughter, which was about my father was a robotics expert who worked at a place called Oak Ridge National Labs, which had a lot of nuclear.
That comes up in these poems, too.
Yeah, it does. And that book was personal, but it was also a little bit at a distance. And I kind of practiced that for a long time. So these poems are way more, for me, difficult to read out loud, difficult to talk about.
Imagine.
They're just a little more challenging because... I'm used to kind of being the fun one in the room, you know. I'm like, oh.
Somehow I can even tell that by your hair.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the fun one. Come on.
You really seem like you. Well, your pictures are deceiving, though, because there's so much that goes on in these poems, and there's so many themes that come out. I want to talk about you. You mentioned Oak Ridge, radioactivity and radiation come up a lot. Talk to me about that in your life.
Well, it's tough because when I was a little girl, we would go out and measure my snowman with my dad's Geiger counter.
Oops.
I mean, I don't think that's a very common experience for children. So I was always my first poem when I was 7 years old was a cloaked metaphor about nuclear pollution. You know, it was a raincoat.
How old were you?
Seven. And I wrote this poem that was like...
So you're a regular Wednesday Addams, right?
It was like a boy in a green raincoat jumps in a mud puddle and it's supposed to represent radiation.
That sounds fascinating. Did your teachers see that poem?
I didn't turn that into my teacher. If my teachers only saw the sunny side, they'll see the sunny side. but yeah, so I've been aware of it. And then I took a class in my bachelor's degrees in biology.
Yeah,
I took a couple classes in. I took a class on environmental law, which is terrifying. Don't ever take that class.
Oh, God.
It's terrible because you just find out lawyers take all the money and nothing is getting cleaned up. And then,
that's why I feel so simpatico to you.
Yeah, it was a depressing class. It was for engineers, too. So they were how much money does it cost the company if somebody dies? I was like, I don't want to talk about this. And the other one was ecotoxicology, which talked about the ecological impact of all these different kinds of poisons, right? One of them was radiation. And my dad, I helped him, proofread papers on Fremnault, which is in Cincinnati, another place where radiation got into the well water and contaminants caused higher rates of cancer there. So it's kind of been in my, literally in my DNA. Since I was a kid,
Did writing these poems help you come to some kind of emotional, sort of confrontation
I think everybody asks, they said, is poetry really healing? And I said, I don't know if it helps you heal, but it helps you define stuff, right?
Did consciously you feel like you're clearer about things?
Right, and you're like, hey, it's not going to make a problem disappear, but, kind of learning how to talk about it to yourself in writing poetry useful, I think. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't fix anything, but it's helpful. And I think even writing about the pandemic, which is something now people probably don't want to read about. It's kind of like the flu of 1918. People wanted to forget it.
But it's interesting. Almost all the artists and writers that I've interviewed in, say, the last year, all of them refer back to the pandemic as their source of when they came up with certain ideas.
Yeah. It's hard to, and I was thinking, I read a ton of literature around the time of the 1918 flu, and the only person who writes about it directly is Catherine Mansfield, and that's in a short story or novella. She has a boyfriend who in real life did die of the flu while she's in a coma or something. But I was like, there wasn't a lot of literature about that, and it killed one out of every 10 Americans.
It's amazing. And several of these poems are about you confronting a terminal diagnosis.
Yeah.
On being told you're dying, but not quite ready, not quite believing it. And there's a great poem about not dead, but post-life.
That's right.
They didn't actually use that term. Tell me they didn't.
No, I think that came from my mom was going through her PhD program, and, when you're post-grad or you're post-dead.
Yep.
Yeah. So you're not graduated, but you're post-dissertation. So I think about using that terminology when you think about your life. What is the after?
Yours is also the first series of poems that I've read that actually contain references to MRIs. Anybody out there, and that's a lot of people, who have been in an MRI, boy, did you capture that experience.
Yeah, I'm terrified of them. I don't.
Well, who isn't? I mean, you're in this confined freaking space that's noisy. I mean, the thing is like right next to your nose.
Yeah,
it's like, and yet they just sort of blithely shove people into these things.
Yeah, and then they say maybe take a Valium, and I'm like maybe 10 Valium would help, but one, I don't. And then the other thing is, they're looking for stuff that, in my case, they were looking for cancer in my liver, they were looking for inflammation in the brain. When they look through the brain, they put a brain cage on you. It's a face mask.
Why? Are you serious?
Yeah, it's way worse, and I had to wear.
So
a
was
mask.
This like Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah, it was terrifying. If you don't like enclosed spaces, that is not a good experience. And then for the abdominal ones, they put a cage around your belly, which just keeps you from breathing, and they keep telling you, breathe.
Jesus.
And like, well, I would, but you've got a cage over that area. So I spent a lot of time. I had to get them every 6 months
from
the time of diagnosis for both MS and for this liver tumors. Now they're calling them tumors. They're not saying it's terminal. It might be a more benign kind of cancer, but they can't get in and biopsy things because I have a bleeding disorder. So it's been fun. It's been super fun.
And the amazing thing is your poems address these issues, but they address them in such a fascinating way.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Well, normally people don't want to hear other people talk about their
you don't want to be a sad sack, right?
Well, you're not a sad sack. I want to emphasize that right now. Here.
I try not to be.
You're not, and it doesn't come across in your writing. But it's also, it makes you really think about your body and your ideas about your body. Did your vision of your body, your sense of self, physical self, did that change while writing the poems, or were you already there?
You know, if you read some of my, if you do read like my previous books of poems, there's references in there to mutation.
And I yes. have a couple of, and there's some in here too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, yeah, I've always had, I have a heritable bleeding disorder. I only have one kidney. I have a twinned uterus. I got some stuff, you know. They don't even know all the stuff I have. You know, they're still testing stuff. So I've always had this view of being the other, the monster, the mutant. That's something I think about a lot. I think it had came up a lot in my writing as horror. And so I got invited to submit to these horror anthologies. And I was like, but I don't write horror.
No, you don't. You don't.
But in their mind.
Well, maybe body horror.
Body horror. Yeah, that's right. But I didn't realize I was doing that. I said, well, my sense of my body is so, it's as a dangerous other, you know. And so it was really interesting to.
Okay, I just want to hold you on that point of seeing your body as the other. And so is there a feeling like I'm outside my body and I'm looking at it?
And also that you just don't fit in, right? That
right, never, right, right.
That you're, you know, you look normal on the, I look pretty normal on the outside.
Yeah, you do.
Except for I carry a cane, I have pink hair, but on the inside, it's not normal, right? Stuff is going on. So it's that sense of being an invisible alien, a person who's walking among you, but not quite like you.
Wow.
Which is, and of course, I was told I couldn't have kids at a really young age,
jeez,
which just made me feel like, oh, I'm not going to be like a normal woman, you know? And that was nailed home pretty young. You know, it's a sense of, you know, my mind has always been my friend, you know what I mean? So when MS hit, it was such a blow because I was like, oh, now I can't even trust my brain, you know?
Well, and that comes up in several of the poems, too, about when they're testing and finding things in your brain, and then you don't feel like you're yourself.
Yeah. And it's
I mean, yourself could get you through all the other physical stuff.
Right.
But once your brain starts, you know, having problems.
Yeah. Then it takes away my, like, for instance, I wasn't able to talk normally or read normally. Those were things I was absolutely frightened to death. I was never going to get back, which I did.
I totally, but was it a struggle?
Yeah, it was like 6 months of therapy, you know.
Jesus.
So it's
Janine. Like,
I know. Holy shit, right? There's a lot of stuff. And that was after the, you know, so one of my thoughts was when I was diagnosed with MS, I was like, well, at least it's not terminal cancer, right? I was kind of upbeat about it. I was like, well, it doesn't kill you in 6 months, so it's got to be something better. And not, at least I was able to focus on the positive part of that. I think
that's sort of a form of bargaining, I think, internally. I don't have cancer, but I have.
But I do have something, and I just, I, you know.
And at least they know what it is.
Yeah, and there is treatment for MS.
Yes,
and there's
there is.
Getting to be more treatment. There's not great treatments, but there's treatments, and they're getting to be better.
And I think most people know somebody who, as an adult, has come down with MS. Yeah.
It's like 1 in 300 people, I think, in America. It's not.
Yeah, it's a pretty common disorder, which also gets me, in the tone of your poems, makes me think about environmental problems that are causing this.
Yeah. Yeah, and we don't really know, right? MS is sort of a mystery still. They don't really know what caused. They're like, maybe a virus, maybe your genetics, maybe something else.
I just,
it's weird, too, because there are poets out there who have MS who didn't really write about it. So it felt like I was writing about it in a vacuum.
Was it liberating?
It was. You know, it was. And I also felt like, I hope other people with MS read this. Because
yes.
When I had it, I was like, none of my, like, I knew poets that had MS. And I'm like, I couldn't find a poem about it, which seems strange, right?
It really seems strange.
I think there's such a stigma around it, you know?
Yeah, and I think people are embarrassed when their body goes awry.
Yeah. Yeah, no one wants that. No, everybody wants to be strong. Well, I was just talking to a male poet friend of mine who said he cried at a poem, and he was so embarrassed. And I was like, yeah, my 50th birthday party was also my book release party. And a friend of mine said, I'd never seen you cry at a poem before. And I said, well, I got MS now. You know, the last book I didn't have that.
Wow.
So it kind of takes away that film between your emotions. You know, you get angry faster, you get sad faster.
Yep.
You don't have that barrier up, you know. So it's, I want to be a badass, but I'm like, I'm just much less badass, you know.
I think these poems are badass.
Oh, thank you.
I think they are. It's tough for you to judge them because you're living inside the poems.
Right, exactly.
But outside, they're pretty badass.
Oh, well, thank you. That's what I'm going for.
Can I ask you to read a poem?
Oh, sure. Do you have one of mine? Or do you want me to choose?
I always want to ask the. I mean, I have like half the book marked as far as poems that I would love to hear, but I wanted you to choose.
All right, I'm going to read a Calamity. Calamity is kind of my favorite poem to read. It's got a little bit of a bite, but a little bit of humor in it. This is Calamity. Your family is coming over for Thanksgiving. Even worse, it's snowing. Headless robots are playing soccer with your soul. UFOs have been sighted overhead. A meteor is definitely heading straight for you. It might miss, but then again. Tonight, a city is being decimated by Godzilla. Or was it a bunch of genetically engineered dinosaurs? Either way, I hope you're lizard-friendly. Tonight, you have to give a speech, and that girl who hated you in third grade will be in the audience. What have I ever done to deserve this? The prophet asks, tearing his robes in the desert. God responds, how long you got? A plague of egrets. A black hole has just opened up, and it is already swallowing someone else's son. Did you see the team play last night? A travesty. Someone is always preaching about doomsday. Who are you wearing? Because tonight your life will be required of you. Grab a bag, a sword, a water bottle. Go out swinging.
That's one of the poems I was going to ask you to read.
Okay, good.
As you said, and there's a poem that every story I tell is an apocalypse story, is a quote from Have I Mentioned Lately. And it does, yes. And it does sort of end up that way. Hold on for a second. We'll do an ID. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Janine Hall Gailey, writer and poet. And we're talking about her new collection of poems, which I just found absolutely interesting, fascinating, and I got a lot out of them. It's called Flare Corona. You should talk about flare and the various meanings of flare.
Yeah, so the meaning actually came up. The book was originally just called Flare, and it came up because when I was diagnosed with MS, they call an MS, when you're having active symptoms, they call it a flare. And at the same time, there was a solar eclipse. Huh. And one of the things I was watching was the solar flares. And I started watching solar weather a lot more closely because I felt like my brain was responding to solar and lunar eclipses and like sunspots and weird solar. And I was like, is my brain connected to this stuff? You start getting really superstitious, you know?
Well, you start feeling like it's part. You are part of everything that's going on around you.
Yeah, and it's kind of spooky because I remember going to the hospital one night with really bad symptoms. It was the night of a lunar eclipse. It was like 3 a.m, and this coyote is sitting in front of our car.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, something's up with the universe. You know? Even when you're really out of it, you're like, something's up. So so the idea of the flare and the corona came from these eclipses, and then, of course, coronavirus came along. Yep. And so it just seemed like the appropriate title, and that's how the art. So the art's supposed to be a solar eclipse, but also with the neural, the neural networks.
Yeah,
supposed to be drawn behind them. So that's sort of the idea of the art.
There are several themes that pop in and out of several of the poems in this collection. One of them is your love of 50s sci-fi movies.
That stands. I'm still there with
it. You don't like them at all?
No, I do. I see it. I'm still in love with. I mean, I just watch them all the time for fun.
The giant leech and killer shrews.
Killer shrews, man. That's a great. If you haven't seen it,
I know you got to see it because they dress dogs up as shrews.
And the lead is the sheriff from Dukes of Hazzard, which I watched when I was a kid. Yeah, it's so bad that it's good. That's that kind of. And there's another one called something about the beginning of the end.
That's one of the first horror movies I saw as a kid.
Giant grasshoppers.
I know.
Awesome. And that's actually a pretty, there's actually good actors in that, kind of in the background. And you're like, oh, these people are pretty good actors.
Yeah, but the special effects are to put an actual grasshopper on, like, a photograph of a building.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
No. Killer Shrews, though, is worth the price of admission because the cheese factor is huge.
It's a laugh a minute for an apocalypse movie. It really. And then if you ever watch Mystery Science 3000, they make fun of the movie. And my favorite line is, those damn Nazi grasshoppers. I don't know why I love that so much. It's so absurd.
Well, speaking of lines, I find myself trying to memorize several lines throughout the poems in this collection. One of the ones I really love is, chaos theory makes beauty of a mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fortunately, that's true.
Yeah. That's, you know, chaos theory is a beautiful science, you know, when you look at it from a larger perspective. Of course, when it comes to you personally, it's not as fun.
But and you also have a lot of natural history references, which I really am, I really love the fact that you did that.
Yeah, it's a little more ecological, you know. It's got
so not all your poetry is like that.
No, I The Robot Scientist's Daughter was a previous book that had specifically nuclear, the dangers of nuclear pollution, but this one seemed a little more far ranging, right? It was like, here's some stuff we're doing to our world. It seems not good. So that's an area of concern. And I feel like I've been writing more of those lately. I was a kid, you know, I was like, oh, environmentalism. But it's really hard to address. It's harder than we think, you know?
Yeah, that's a sad thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're living in weird times. I mean,
we are.
And so I think it's a total a normal response to write dark about stuff like this.
Yeah, well, it's really hard, you know, I'm kind of a person who I'm kind of tired of these depressing dystopian novels, you know, have all this youth dystopian. I'm like, let's do a happier future.
A happy dystopian novel.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be something. We got to be able, because if we can't imagine it, we can't produce it, you know.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Oh, sure.
Because I want to squeeze two in before we run out of time, which we're going to do.
Oh, my God. Okay. No pressure. I'm going to read Irradiate. It's the first poem.
Ooh, yeah. Okay.
Irradiate. As a child, I was radiant. The land grew irradiated corn and roses, tomatoes large and abundant, swallows and catfish carrying the isotopes through the water and woods. The sun rose each day while the shadows of trees concealed government laboratories where my father worked. I grew up listening to the tap click of the Geiger counter. I grew up listening to clicks on the phone line. I was still innocent, irradiated, to blast with radiation, to sterilize food, medical equipment, a person. I was waiting for a message from the sky. I knew what it meant to illuminate the fall of light in a painting or through an old window that irradiated a field of flowers of the face of someone you loved, to bring the full beauty of something to the surface. I was irradiated by the gentle glow of the computer screen, by the microwave, by the sun growing brighter each spring, dimmer each fall. I meant I was full of radiation. I meant I was full of light. I meant I could give birth to nothing but light.
That's an amazing poem.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, do you have writing rituals? Do you write at certain times of the day?
I do. I'm a nighttime writer. I write best at 3 a.m. It's crazy.
Are you always up at 3 a.m.?
I'm a chronic insomniac, and that's probably why I write so much. You know, so quiet, you're alone, it's great.
You're right. I totally get that. I usually get up around that time. And it's for the same reason. You know, it's like it's quiet, and I love that. I love hearing the morning dawn chorus of birds.
Yeah, I'm a big nighttime person. So.
So I wanted to understand, at what point in your life did you call yourself a poet when you knew that's what you were?
You know, I had a teacher who, in the fifth grade, who pulled me aside and was like, you should be writing 5 poems a day, every day.
Wow.
And I was 10. I was very impressionable. I was like, okay, I guess that's what you do, you know, right? You just started doing that. And then my mom, I remember when I was 18 or 19, it's like, well, to be a real poet, you have to get 100 rejection slips, right? This is back in the day of paper, CZs, you know, Poets Market was a book, not online.
Wow.
So it was like, okay, so now I submit 100 times. It was like it was incrementally there. And then I worked as a technical writer for 12 years, fairly happily and successfully, until my health stuff just got in the way of being able to work 90-hour work weeks in the tech sector. And that's what brought me out to Seattle, was Microsoft. And so I had to quit that job. And then my husband's like, well, why don't you try being a writer? And I was like, yeah, but why don't I try that? Seems like it was a good fit for my health situation at the time. And that's when I really started, you know, writing and sending out seriously.
And it was at that period that you felt comfortable to call yourself a poet.
Yeah, that's when I started really calling. I was like, I'm a writer now, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's like you had a dynamic start as a young child.
You know, I was really into it. I read my mom's college textbook, Poetry, Introduction to Poetry by X.J. Kennedy, which I totally recommend, 1969 version with my mom's notes. Great.
Was your mother a poet too?
She wasn't, but she loved poetry. So I was introduced to it really young, right? Like, my mom read me poetry. She talked poetry with me. We talked about T.S. Eliot when I was 10.
Oh,
my
nice.
Favorite poem when I was 10 years old was Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
I totally get that because I've read that about that age, too.
That's and like, you're like, I get it, midlife.
Right. And right. That's such a big thing when you're young, when you feel like you got it.
Terrifying. Oh, yeah, 100%. And, you know, Eliot was only 29 when he wrote that thing. Crazy.
Now, we're almost completely out of time. I noticed that you're really good at promoting yourself. Was that a steep learning curve? It's so important if poets only understood that.
Yeah, and I feel like it's something you owe to your publisher as well. You know, they work hard to bring out your book. It's up to you to help sell that book for them. You know, they took a risk on you. So, and I've always had tiny publishers. Bo is the biggest press I've had. And they're doing a great job. They have a marketing person. But on my first 5 books, I was doing it all by myself. So it's kind of like you have to get out there and do the social media, do a website, you know, do your readings. It's tough, but I think that's how your poetry gets out there. You know, it's hard to be a champion for your own stuff. I understand that. It feels squeamish, but I think it's just something you do to respect your publisher, you respect your work. You know?
That's right. And so many poets don't know that or think that somehow the world is going to beat a path to their door.
Yeah.
And it's the easiest thing in the world to ignore a poet. And I'm not being a wise ass saying that.
No, it's true.
It's true. And so unless you really work at it, and first of all, don't expect success right away.
Right.
Like you did. You're really good at promoting yourself and promoting your events. How important are live readings to you?
I love them. Although during the pandemic, you know, we were doing a lot more Zoom readings.
Yeah.
But I've done a few live readings since the book came out, and it's been fantastic. I love meeting people. I love the energy, the audience. It's been fantastic to be back.
When your next collection comes out, can we talk again?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest tonight has been Janine Hall Gailey, writer and poet. And we've been talking about her new collection of poems, which I just really... adored. I really got into them. Flair, Corona. Janine, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.